The Gonzaga Socratic Club seeks to promote open philosophical inquiry into the Christian worldview. In the spirit of Socrates, our aim is to follow the argument wherever it leads, concerning the truth of Christian doctrine and practice. We take our name and inspiration from the Oxford Socratic Club, which was founded at Oxford University in 1941 and was presided over by the famous Christian scholar, author, and apologist C.S. Lewis from its founding until his move to Cambridge University in 1954. So that's who we are. In the Jewish and Christian traditions, responsibility toward the environment has been framed in the terms of stewardship, the idea that humans are designated by God to subdue and have dominion over the earth. Critics, especially those in an era of increasing environmental awareness, have noted that an environmental ethic premised on stewardship can be used to exploit and abuse nature. Indeed, in a message commemorating the World Day of Peace on January 1, 1990, late Pope John Paul II pointed out that one implicit message of the creation account in Genesis is that human dominion can be exercised in constructive ways, but also in destructive ways. As he notes, made in the image and likeness of God, Adam and Eve were to have exercised their dominion over the earth with wisdom and love. Instead, they destroyed the existing harmony by deliberately going against the Creator's plan, that is, by choosing to sin. This resulted not only in man's alienation from himself, in death and fratricide, but also in the earth's rebellion against him. According to John Paul II, the coming of Christ signals not only spiritual redemption for human beings, but also the possibility of renewed and life-affirming conception of stewardship. This possibility, the rehabilitation of the idea of stewardship, is the subject of today's meeting of the Gonzaga Socratic Club. Our speaker today is Professor Brian G. Henning, who joined the Gonzaga Philosophy Department just last fall. His research and teaching is focused on relationships between ethics, metaphysics, and aesthetics. His recent book, The Ethics of Creativity, Beauty, Morality, and Nature in a Processive Cosmos, published by University of Pittsburgh, was the 2007 winner of the Findley Book Prize of the Metaphysical Society of America. As co-chair of the newly formed Gonzaga Advisory Council on Stewardship and Sustainability, Dr. Henning is both philosophically and practically well-suited to address the question of stewardship and sustainability. So let's welcome Dr. Henning to speak to us.
Thank you very much, Professor Calhoun. I want to thank the Socratic Club and in particular Professor Calhoun for this very generous invitation to speak. It's a great way to get to know a community by sharing some of your scholarship, and I wanted to leave lots of time for comments and questions and Father Wood's remarks as well. So I will jump right into it. So to set the context for our discussion, I'd like to begin by getting a sense as to the health of our natural environment. According to one author, the gradual depletion of the ozone layer and the related greenhouse effect has now reached crisis proportions as a consequence of industrial growth, massive urban concentrations, and vastly increased energy needs. Industrial waste, the burning of fossil fuels, unrestricted deforestation, the use of certain types of herbicides, coolants and propellants, all of these are known to harm the atmosphere and the environment. The resulting meteorological and atmospheric changes range from damage to health to the possible future submersion of low-lying lands. We have global warming, we have species extinction, massive deforestation, increased desertification, overpopulation, the salinization of fresh water, toxic waste disposal. It's problems such as these that have led many to conclude with the author of this passage that we are in the midst of an environmental crisis. Yet there continue to be large groups of individuals who are dubious of the severity or even the existence of these so-called environmental problems. In fact, just this weekend I couldn't resist. I think if this works, I found a good advertisement.
Hey there, I'm Carlton, the wealthy ego immigrant. I inherited my money and attended fancy schools. I own 3 homes and 5 cars, but I always talk with my rich friends about saving the planet. And I want Congress to spend billions on programs in the name of global warming and green energy. Even if it causes massive unemployment, higher energy bills, and digs people like you deeper into the recession. Who knows? I'll probably make money off of it.
Isn't time Congress listened to the rest of us and got its science and priorities straight?
Couldn't resist. So, we've got two competing views. One of growing environmental crisis, another of much to do about nothing. So as this suggests, some, though mercifully I would say their numbers seem to be dwindling, some suspect that this environmental crisis is merely the fabrication of granola-eating, tree-hugging, sandal-wearing, trust fund hypocrites that care more about baby seals and redwoods than about loggers and fishermen. Besides, they often add, if any of these issues become problematic, we will surely be able to develop new technologies that will solve our problems. Environmental issues such as these, they conclude, are comparatively small matters that concern economics and technology, and are certainly not an ethical concern. If you find yourself agreeing with this sort of assessment, you may be surprised to learn that this passage was not written by an environmental activist. Rather, these words were part of a speech entitled "The Ecological Crisis, A Common Responsibility," delivered on January 1st, 1990 by Pope John Paul II. In this speech, the Pope is unequivocal in declaring not only that there is an ecological crisis, but that, quote, "the ecological crisis is a moral issue." So in my brief comments this evening, I'm not primarily interested in following this political debate, which is very interesting, but rather I'm interested, like John Paul II, first of all, in just taking it as given that there is an ecological crisis, but we could spend lots of time, we could debate to what degree that is the case. I'm going to take it as given. Instead, I'm more interested in examining the relationship, or the lack thereof, between environmental stewardship and Christianity. It's my contention that, first, Christianity bears some historical burden for having engendered an attitude toward nature that was conducive to it too. Contrary to this historical interpretation, proper scriptural exegesis reveals that respect for nature is in fact a fundamental part of Christian faith. So we have a historical claim and then a claim about contemporary exegesis being two different movements. Many scholars seeking to explain the historical roots of the mounting ecological crisis point to a particular attitude which holds that nature's sole purpose is to serve humans. This is what philosophers sometimes call an anthropocentric view of reality. Taken literally, anthropocentrism simply means human-centered. In its technical sense, anthropocentrism is the view that the entire created order only gains meaning and value in its relationship to humans. In a now famous article entitled "The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis," Lynn White Jr. argues that Christianity, in fact, should take much of the blame for creating and perpetuating this destructive attitude. According to White, Christianity, particularly in its Western form, is the most anthropocentric religion the world has ever seen. He writes, quote, "God planned all of this explicitly for man's benefit and rule. No item in the physical creation had any purpose save to serve man's purposes. And although man's body is made of clay, he is not simply part of nature, he is made in God's image." Thus, White continues, quote, "Despite Copernicus, all the cosmos rotates around our little globe. Despite Darwin, we are not, in our hearts, part of the natural process. We are superior to nature, contemptuous of it, willing to use it for our slightest whims." End quote. According to White, not only does Christianity set up a dualism whereby humans are separate from nature, Scripture also reveals that it is God's will that humans exploit nature to achieve our proper end. After all, Genesis 1 clearly indicates that humans are to subdue the earth and to have dominion over every living creature. According to this interpretation, in making humans divinely appointed despots over nature, Christianity is inherently an anti-environmental. There's only one conclusion to be drawn from this, according to White. Quote, "We shall continue to have a worsening ecological crisis until we reject the Christian axiom that nature has no reason for existence save to serve man." Now, historically speaking, It is the case that many influenced by Christianity have justified their exploitation of nature by explicitly or more often implicitly relying on the account of creation in Genesis 1, wherein God gives humans dominion over creation and orders them to subdue it. So, historically speaking, I think it's actually relatively uncontroversial to say that the modification of an ancient paganism whereby nature was guarded by guardian spirits which would restrict morally what I ought to do to nature, replacing it with a view of nature whereby humans are set up as distinct from nature and in which nature is for humans, changes that from a moral relationship between humans and the world to mostly an economic relationship limited only by its indirect relationship to other humans. Yet, so I think that historical claim in order to diagnose the current problem. Separate from the diagnosis, I'm interested in wondering whether or not, in fact, it's good exegesis in the first place, whether that interpretation of dominion is in fact the best one. So I'm relying here, since I'm not a theologian, I'm relying on Sister Anne Clifford, who I take as representative of a growing body of theologians who are replacing a renewed focus on the scriptural basis of humanity's relationship to the natural world. In her excellent essay, Foundations for a Catholic Ecological Theology of God, Clifford agrees with White and others that, quote, for much of the 20th century, non-human nature has been treated by Christian theologians as a mere context in which human beings work out their salvation with the help of God's grace, end quote. Yet, as Clifford goes on to note, there is nothing necessary in this interpretation. In contradistinction, Clifford begins by explicitly addressing White's claim that Christianity is inherently anthropocentric, arguing instead that if we properly understand our relationship to creation, we begin to recognize that the Bible is not anthropocentric, it is not human-centered, it is primarily and essentially theocentric, God-centered. It is only in God that the origin and meaning of all creations is to be found, Clifford argues. This recentering of the Bible has an important effect on how one interprets the creation story in general and the notion of dominion in particular. Following several other contemporary scholars, Clifford argues that to properly understand the full meaning of dominion, one must put it in the context of the story of the great flood. She writes, in chapter 6 of Genesis, we find God deeply grieved about the extent of the wickedness of humans, precipitating an ecological disaster of worldwide proportions. God's directive to build an ark for all animals makes the meaning of having dominion clear, she writes. It is to see the survival of the other living creatures. The Noahic covenant is a symbol of the unbreakable bond between all creatures and their creator. So interpreting dominion in this context emphasizes at least two things. First, in that God's covenant was made not only with Noah, but with every living creature, we must remember that although humans are unique, we are still a part of the interconnected web of nature. Properly understood, therefore, Christianity does not entail an absolute dualism between humans and creation. Although we are not limited to nature, we are very much a part of nature. Secondly, as Clifford succinctly notes, God's commandment to build an ark for an animal's, quote, makes the meaning of having dominion clear. It is to see the survival of other living creatures. So understood within the context of the Noahic covenant, dominion does not mean humans have license to use nature with impunity. Rather, to be given dominion is to be charged with the grave responsibility to care for and protect God's creation for present and future generations. In class, I'm frequently trying to use the example, although it's dated as well now, from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the last of the trilogy, The Return of the King. You have the Steward of Gondor, right, the crazy guy who runs off the cliff and he's on fire. Right, but the idea being that the steward is—he doesn't own the kingdom. It's not his to take care of the kingdom. He's supposed to, in waiting for the king to return. So the idea of a steward is not one of a despot, if it's understood correctly, but rather one of a caretaker, whereby one does not own what one takes care of, but rather holds it in trust for the true owner, which should change how we understand that term. As Clifford concludes. When humans abuse the charge of dominion given to them, taking upon themselves the domination of the rest of creation as their possession, instead of respecting the charge entrusted to them by God, all of creation suffers. There is no biblical basis for justifying this exploitation of the earth and its many forms of plant and animal life. Such behavior breaks God's covenant with creation and is a sin against the Creator. Because of such sin, a mournful dirge is heard throughout the land. All of creation suffers. It is for this reason, perhaps, that John Paul II argues that, quote, Christians must realize that their responsibility within creation and their duty towards nature and the Creator are an essential part of their faith. End quote. Thus, rather than seeing environmental awareness as a movement extrinsic to their own faith, foreign to it, or even opposed to it, many Christians are beginning to reawaken to what might be called the sacramental role of nature. No longer should Christians see the natural environment as a mere resource to be disposed of as one pleases. Rather, nature provides a unique encounter with God. After all, from Wisdom 13:5, from the greatness and the beauty of created things, the original author, by analogy, is seen. Thus, as a unique overflowing of divine goodness, every creature is revelatory of God. Every part of creation is an overflowing of divine goodness. Taken in this renewed scriptural and sacramental light, not only is there ample reason to reject the view that Christianity necessarily entails an anthropocentric anti-environmentalism, in fact, the Christian faith requires that each of us take seriously our grave responsibility as stewards of creation. According to this model, human beings do not own the earth, but hold it in trust for both present and future generations. By continuing our unsustainable addiction to non-renewable energy sources, by continuing to undermine international efforts to curb global climate change, by continuing to ignore the dramatic increases in species extinctions, we are hurting not only ourselves, but are bequeathing to future generations a poorer quality of life than we have received. Properly understood, then, environmental stewardship should be seen as a natural part of a consistent ethic of life, which requires that we respect both human and non-human forms of life. In John Paul II's words, respect for life and the dignity of the human person extends also to the rest of creation, which are called to join man in praising God. Thus, respect for and protection of non-human forms of life is an important part of the culture of life that Christianity seeks to foster. The U.S. Conference of Bishops are surprisingly forceful in their inclusion of the respect for nature, going so far as to claim that the mistreatment of the natural world not only, quote, diminishes our own dignity and sacredness and destroys resources needed by future generations, but such mistreatment, in fact, quote, contradicts what it means to be human, end quote. Our tradition... Our tradition, they continue, calls us to protect the life and dignity of the human person, and it is increasingly clear that this task cannot be separated from the care and defense of all creation. End quote. Before turning to my final, more practical comments, I'd like to briefly consider the argument that I was intending to be implicit in my title. There is, I would suggest, a difference between sustainability and stewardship. The discussion of sustainable development only began less than 25 years ago. As a result, scholars are still debating the meaning of basic terms. However, if one were to point to a classical definition of sustainable development, it would be from the 1987 UN Brundtland Commission, which defined it as development that, quote, meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. Exactly how many future generations one must consider is unclear. However, the basic idea is that we ought to pursue development that can be indefinitely maintained. Although it does hint at an ethical dimension in that we ought not to compromise the ability of future generations to meet their needs, in many ways the notion of sustainability is more of a physiochemical category than it is a moral one. It is, in a sense, neutral as to what form of life should be pursued. It only suggests that we ought to pursue forms of life which can be maintained indefinitely. It is, in this sense, a morally thin concept, if it is indeed a moral concept at all. The notion of stewardship, on the other hand, is potentially a full-bodied moral concept involving not only a sense of moral obligation to future generations, as we saw above, but also calls for forms of development that are more consistent with what it means to be human. Thus, rather than speaking of sustainable development, Catholic social teaching refers to the notion of authentic development. In their pastoral letter, which was a response to Pope John Paul II's 1990 speech, the U.S. bishops wrote a pastoral letter called Renewing the Earth. And they describe authentic development in the following way. Authentic development supports moderation and even austerity in the use of natural resources. It also encourages a balanced view of human progress consistent with respect for nature. Furthermore, it invites the development of alternative visions of the good society and the use of economic models with richer standards of well-being than material productivity alone. Authentic development also requires affluent nations to seek ways to reduce and restructure their overconsumption of natural resources. In a very countercultural sense, the notion of authentic development calls into question the notion that standard of living should be equated with the number of goods one can buy. It rejects the unnecessary consumption that is at the heart of our current economic models and invites the development of economic models with richer standards of well-being. More than just sustainable, authentic development concerns a fundamental notion of human flourishing. It is, in this sense, a much more full-bodied moral concept than the current understandings of sustainability. Though still a demanding concept, we must aim not only for sustainability, but also for responsible stewardship. As John Paul II himself notes, while in some cases the damage already done may be irreversible, in many other cases it still can be halted. It is necessary, however, that the entire human community, individuals, states, universities, I would add, international bodies, must take seriously the responsibility that is theirs. John Paul II's call for each of us to take responsibility for our treatment of the earth provides a natural transition to the last portion of my comments, which, in the spirit of taking responsibility for our treatment of nature, focuses on some very specific things that we at Gonzaga are presently doing and several things that we have, I think, the moral obligation to focus on in order to take our responsibility for nature more seriously. There are, thankfully, many signs that the ecological awareness of which the Pope speaks is growing here at Gonzaga University. First of all, we have the student organization, which has existed for quite some time. I don't know, Dan, do you know how long the Gonzaga Environmental Organization, Dan was a member when he was a student, so, and he's a young man, but a little while.
I think early 90s, anyway.
So it's been in existence for quite some time and has been the student organization focused on these issues for a good long while. ASHI, the university is just now forming in the last year or two a chapter of the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education, which is a group mainly of engineering-focused students, which is also doing a lot of very good work. You can find out their web address here. By the way, G. Moreno is the president for GEO right now. So we have an ASHI chapter, and you can find out more about that. We also have a newly formed environmental studies concentration, which is directed by Dr. Isaacoff from the Political Science Department. And you can find out more about the environmental studies concentration as well. And then finally, we have, as Dr. Calhoun just mentioned, the Advisory Council on Stewardship and Sustainability, which was just approved less than a month ago, as an advisory council directly to the president's cabinet, which is composed of faculty, students, and staff on campus. We're charged now with making sure that we're doing, understanding what we're doing already and doing a better job in the future. So we have a lot to be proud of, and in fact, part of the point of the council is to broadcast all of the good work that it's already been done on campus for quite some time. There are things that I think we should look to be doing in the future as well, and one of the things that I'll be pushing the Advisory Council to be looking at is considering being a signatory to the American College and University President's Climate Commitment, which is something that a president signs and declares that it commits its institution to becoming climate neutral in the some distant future. But it's a public declaration of one's commitment to reducing one's carbon footprint with a clear public sign of one's understanding of the significance of climate change. Secondly, and I think this, thankfully, is probably going to happen soon, but the university should develop a full environmental studies major and minor, and students should readily enroll in it. Thirdly, and more broadly, I think that beyond just environmental studies as a concentration which somebody can decide to dedicate themselves to as a specialization, I think even more important would be the integration of environmental courses and ideas more broadly into the curriculum. Some universities have, in fact, made it part of their mission statement and incorporated a sort of ecological awareness as part of and one of the defining goals of an undergraduate curriculum. I think that would be something consistent with what I've been describing today. And of course, as a shameless plug, I would encourage you to take my own courses on the subject, where we can get into and do get into these things in quite a bit more detail. So I'd like to conclude with just a nice quotation from the 1991 pastoral statement, Renewing the Earth. The U.S. bishops write, "Today humanity is at a crossroads. Having read the signs of the times, we can either ignore the harm that we see and witness further danger, or we can take up our responsibilities to the Creator and creation with renewed courage and commitment. The task set before us is unprecedented, intricate, and complex. No single solution will be adequate to the task. To live in balance with the finite resources of the planet, we need an unfamiliar blend of restraint and innovation." I would note that we're doing a better job of innovation interest, and not so much on the restraint side. It's not very fun. "We shall be required to be genuine stewards of nature and thereby co-creators of a new human world. This will require both new attitudes and new actions." Thank you very much for your attention.
We're going to need a moment here for some technological transition, so if you'll bear with
us. We need some music and playing in the background. Not that music.
It's just technological.
Back and forth if you want. It's just that simple. If you want, it's up to you. I'll leave it there.
This would be a great time for you to grab some goldfish or a drink if you haven't done that already. It is the tradition and practice at the Gonzaga Socratic Club to promote discussion and conversation on the issues that we are addressing. And so, to facilitate that, and in the spirit of promoting conversation, it's our practice to have a designated commentator speak after presentations. And so, that's what you're lining up here. Our commentator, I'll go ahead and introduce him while he's busy at work. So he's distracted, but I want to get us moving along here anyway. Our response today is offered by Michael Woods of the Society of Jesus, who is a professor in the Religious Studies Department here at Gonzaga, where he has been since fall of 2007. So it's kind of interesting, we have two relatively new folks here speaking on our topic today. Father Woods is a Jesuit of the Maryland province who was ordained in 2004. He received his doctorate degree from the Catholic University of America in liturgical studies, and for which he wrote a dissertation that explored the contributions of Catholic agrarians to the American liturgical movement. That's also connected with another interest that he has, the question of sustainability, especially as it applies to rural communities in the United States. So he is, like Dr. Henning, uniquely suited and prepared to address our topic. And as soon as he gets set up here, PC. We'll go. Oh, it's, yeah. It took a nap.
Took a nap?
Yeah, so it does that sometimes.
Sounds like a great idea on a Friday afternoon. Can folks see back there? I feel like you have to do an eye test, you know, kind of L, E. Okay,
we'll give this back.
Okay, so thanks, Brian. For those who are looking for a more combative debate, you're not going to get it because we're kind of sympathetic minds. I'm on the advisory committee for sustainability stewardship and so forth. But I just want to just kind of pick up on a few of his points and respond. And of course, I'm a theologian, so I'm going to comment that from a more theocentric view, as Brian actually talks about in his paper. But what I'm calling this is, are we home yet? And I'm going to unpack the word home, which has a rather profound Greek origin, oikos. And we'll do it literarily with some literary stuff, some pictures.
It's not cooperating.
If you had trouble seeing that screen, you'd have trouble seeing these little pictures here. You know, some cartoons. Give it a sec.
I tried turning it back on and it doesn't seem to want to go on. Ah, finally. I heard it cycle off. Here we go.
Okay. Right is forward. Okay, so Chris Madden, who's out of the UK, the Ship of Fools and the Rocks of Short-Term Economic Planning. Brian talked about economics on several occasions, and that is very much going to be part of the concern. As E.F. Schumacher said some years ago in his book Small is Beautiful, doing economics as if people mattered, It's a fundamentally relational word. So a brief fourfold response. Some literary Sabbath vision and its desecration. An etymology of home. A paschal sacramental imagination, which I think is fundamental. And some practical suggestions. Literary. Be thankful and repay. Growth with good work and care. Work done in gratitude, kindly and well, is prayer. From the very noted author and farmer, agrarian, Wendell Berry, who, in my estimation, is a bit of a prophet. The economic disaster unfolding, he's been talking about it for 40 years. So I recommend taking up his work. So the Sabbath vision from the Jewish philosopher, theologian, activist, Abraham Heschel. What we are depends on what the Sabbath means to us, and it is not merely an interlude or a pullback from the daily push of life, but it is in point of fact the climax of living. So in his very, very powerful little book, The Sabbath, he talks about entering into the holiness of time. It's not just pulling back from the tyranny of space and things, and that the Sabbath is actually an entrance into time. And it's not just a day a week. He's saying it's fundamentally how we have to look at the world. And central to his Sabbath vision of the world is this deep sharing in creation, right? In creation, in family, and in community. Right? So it's a different way of seeing the world, and the economic and ecological crisis, as we'll see connected, it is requiring simply a new vision, a new way of looking at the world. Yet, such harmony seems distant. The Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, published back in 1999, a document called We Live in a Broken World, and it is sort of the most authoritative statement the Jesuits have made as regards the environmental crisis, ecology. But it says unscrupulous exploitation of natural resources and the environment degrades the quality of life. So in that background, Brian's points of John Paul II, that disrespect life is not a single issue. It is a totality. As Cardinal Bernardine called it, the seamless garment. It is an integral and whole sacramental vision of the world. Destroys cultures and sinks the poor into misery. So Wendell Berry also takes up this topic of nature and culture, that they are intimately related. And I want to give some real practical examples about this degradation of cultures and driving more people into desperate conditions. Now, as I say that phrase, some people are probably thinking, oh, these desperate third world places. Read the newspaper. It's right here in our neighborhoods. It is hard-working middle-class families who are also being driven to some extreme ends. So I speak of Appalachia, where I've spent some time, in particular in the hills of West Virginia, in which had a rich, rich culture until the outside exploiters came to take the coal and the logs. The entire region of Appalachia has been logged, almost every single tree. They cut off the tops of mountains. And so that's the extraction, the exploitation of nature. But what in point of fact it has done is driven a people into poverty and has wiped out a culture that was rich in music and traditions and storytellings. And it has fragmented that world. A good Jesuit friend, Father Xavier Bosco, who is Indian, as from India, I met a few summers ago at a parish back in Baltimore. And Father Xavier Bosco is a Dalit. He has a PhD in economics. So that should tell you something. Dalits are among the lower class in the caste system. And he was working in and among other Dalits, farmers. And in one summer, over a two-month period, 125 of those farmers committed suicide. Why? Because of certain transnational corporations which were forcing their Terminator seeds upon these groups who have been farming somewhat sustainably and healthily for generations. So the sense that technological progress and so forth is always understood as something positive, but it can create to the degradation of cultures and peoples, poverty. Finally, did anyone see the red gold? Raise your hand if you saw red gold. Not a single one. Oh. So this is about the Pebble Mine of in Alaska, Bristol Bay. A very powerful documentary, and one of the panelists was a native of that area. And I didn't ask my question publicly, but I asked it privately afterwards. The native spirituality is so connected to nature. And I asked simply, how can you plunder nature and preserve your culture? And she didn't have, I would say, a good answer. And she said, no, we will maintain our traditions. But I question whether or not that's going to be very possible. Okay? So these things are playing out, this destruction. And I'm going to come back to that nature and culture as part of the sacramental view. It just never stops. Munch. In his collection of essays, Citizenship Papers, Barry, in his essay called Thoughts in the Presence of Fear, sort of about 30 sort of edicts about life in our country and the world now, there will come a time when we'll not be able to remember the horrors of September 11th without also remembering the unquestioning technological and economic optimism that ended that day. This optimism rested on the proposition that we are living in a new world order. You hear these words every single day in the news. Every day. We have global problems. We need global solutions. I would challenge that. And a new economy that would grow on and on, bringing a prosperity of which every new increment would be unprecedented. So this is one of the challenges I would make towards technology. It happens so fast, we have no chance to actually ponder its potential benefit. I am no Luddite, right? The Luddites, those people in 19th century England who are often pegged as rejecting technology. But in point of fact, what they were questioning was, what would this technology do to our community? So they were asking a fundamentally relational question. John Cavanaugh, the Jesuit at St. Louis, who's written a book that's been written in several editions, Finding Christ or Falling Christ in a Consumer Society, challenges sort of our consumer mentality and how it becomes actually a way of reality. So, in essence, this is what I want to really push. The Greek word for home, oikos, is actually refers to a household economy, right? Home economics. Titled in other collections by Wendell Berry. Home economics is not making your mother an apron that she wears in the kitchen, which if some of you had those courses. My mother still wears my apron that I made, even my brother's apron that she made. But it is a much, much more complex reality. And it is fundamentally relationship. It is the root for ecology, for economy, and for oikoumenos, ecumenical, which is not Catholic Protestants getting together and talking about religion, but it is that more ancient saints of the entire inhabited world. Economy, in my estimation, is perhaps one of the most abused words in our language today. It has become so unhinged from this deeper notion of where the oikos is that communities of care, sustainable, good stewards, will be mindful of each and every one of these components. That you simply cannot pillage the earth and maintain a healthy community, a healthy relationship, family life. This isn't just among community, but again, the culture and the people. And so in Christian theology, we often talk about the economy of salvation, the unfolding in creation, the incarnation, the paschal mystery, Jesus is dying and rising. So what I'm going to say is that that's also an economy of gratitude, so the Wendell Berry prayer. So to give you maybe a concrete example of how this plays out, in one of his essays on preserving wildness, in his essays, he says this, good workmanship, that is, careful, considerate, and loving work, requires us to think considerately of the whole process, natural and cultural, involved in the making of wooden artifacts, because the good woodworker does not share the industrial contempt for raw material. The good woodworker loves the board before it becomes a table, loves the tree before it yields the board, and loves the forest before it gives up a tree. So one of his quick answers is, stop making crappy wood products where we have to decimate forests. Things that are well made with care and have good use take on a greater sacramental value. They're honored. So we have to share these traditions. Bring them up with the kids. Right? Inspire them. Hand on the traditions. Grow a garden. Okay, so the paschal sacramental imagination, in conclusion. By not conserving it, soil, the farmer has sinned against it. By conservation, man is expiating his sin and making restitution. This makes soil conservation a pious act. This comes from Monsignor George Alfalfa Hildner, a priest and minister in rural Missouri back in the 1930s and 40s, who won conservation awards. And then back to Wendell Berry. It is not to suggest that we can live harmlessly or strictly at our own expense. We depend on other creatures and survive by their deaths. To live, we must daily break the body and shed the blood of creation. But here's the difference. The point is, when we do this knowingly, lovingly, skillfully, reverently, it is sacrament. When we do it ignorantly, greedily, clumsily, destructively, it is desecration. In so doing, we condemn ourselves to spiritual and moral loneliness and others to want. again, the nature-culture connection. Right, so the Greek word for sacrament is mysterion. It is mystery. And Christians are to be stewards of that sacramental universe. Jesus took bread in his hands, something of the earth, and blessed it, as all good Jews would do. And in that, he altered our relationship with creation. He hallowed those things of the earth. I would point to John chapter 9, too, when he spits on the earth and makes a mud spittle and heals the blind man. Okay, so something sacramental. So in our liturgy, we sing Holy, Holy from Isaiah. Heaven and earth are full of your glory. Are they? Are they really? So my work in liturgy and farming and the new agrarianism has this whole sort of holistic and sacramental worldview. And not just theoretically, it's actually worked out in practice. And this, the movement, the liturgical movement's motto, to restore all things in Christ. So particularly sacramental and Christian perspective, I think, is very ripe for further development. So praxis need to confront our consumerist ways, invites new forms of asceticism, downsizing, if you will, to recover all eating and drinking as sacrament. If you're familiar with the slow food movement, there's a slow food convivium here in Spokane. I was at an event just last night. And the word convivium is a beautiful word. It is a joyful living together. And we'll make a plug as well for the Main Market Food Cooperative, which is opening up in downtown Spokane at the corner of Main and Brown. I'm not sure if I can get out of here. And I'm not sure if I'm going to get out of here and get back to here. So let me do this. I'll come back to the website, but the time is now, and I say that with the liturgical word so prevalent in our liturgy, hodie, which is today, which is an eschatological sense of time. It encompasses all of time. Okay. Visit the Main Markets page. It is a food cooperative which will stock its shelves with food that is sustainably grown, local. It supports the ECOS in the best sense of the word. Strong local regional economies, supporting farmers and ranchers who grow their food in sustainable ways. People who are great stewards of the land. Right? And it fosters a deeper sense of community. You actually know the people who grow and raise your food. Thank you.
Our time now is open for questions. If you'd like to direct a question to one speaker in particular, you can do that. Or if you'd like to just throw a general question out, go ahead. I'll let you guys respond.
Seeing over, a lot of your sources of came from Catholic authors. Does the Catholic view differ from a Protestant Mormonism view as Christian stewards, or is it just continue on the chill?
I've done more research on the Catholic background, so I can speak more authoritatively. But I can say with some certainty that in the evangelical community, it's a little bit later in coming, but just as vigorous in the last 3 to 5 years, I would say. That there's a really vibrant sense of environmental awareness motivated by a serious stewardship in the evangelical community. I don't know at all about whether or not in Mormonism there is an active sense of this. But mainline Protestant denominations are very much on the same wavelength as the Catholics at this point, and are surprisingly strong, given that they're normally associated with a very right, the political right. But now they're really motivating very seriously a serious concern for the environment, which is usually associated with a left issue, which is, I think, wonderful, in the sense that you get to mix up these traditional sort of right-left issues and note that it's coming from both directions for different reasons. But So it's a good point for convergence in interest.
I would have a little brief response. You want to check out the work called, it's a movement called the New Monasticism. Okay, so the New Monasticism, there's actually up at Whitworth, there's a Knox House, as the famous Presbyterian theologian minister. But the New Monasticism, very interesting, monasticism, so I didn't mention St. Benedict, but in that opening line from Wendell Berry, right, when a monastery, a group of monks set up a huge monastery, they're there. They take vows of stability. And so they can't plunder the earth around them. They have to cultivate it because it's going to be a place of enduring legacy and tradition. And so very interesting is that this new monasticism movement is recovering some of this very thing. So intentional communities, meals together, studying together, praying together, and cultivating gardens and attending to creation with a little bit more mindfulness. So you might want to check out some of that stuff college groups doing.
Dr. Henning, historically the Christian tradition played itself out in the dominion model. Though, as you point out, and we've come to understand over the past 30 or 40 years, the Christian tradition has more than ample resources philosophically and theologically for an ethic of stewardship. But there still seems to be that troublesome ontological divide that won't go away. Criticisms off the environmental philosophy over the past 30 or 40 years is that even though you might develop a fairly robust ethic of stewardship, it's still an instrumental ethic at its core. And that you can't develop within the Christian tradition an environmental ethic that affords any kind of intrinsic value to nature. Because, to put fairly succinctly, it lacks a soul. So, do you think that's fair? That seems to be the consensus of view.
I do think it's somewhat fair to say, but not. But I think it's more complicated. I think you can go two ways. You can go for a really enlightened anthropocentrism. You can by extending our concern to not only present but future generations, you can get a lot of mileage out of that. And then there's another option, though. A complete and thorough theocentrism is not at all clear what that would look like. And meaning that if all meaning and value is strictly speaking constituted by something's relationship to the divine, then the divine is the only thing that's intrinsically valuable then. And so some Protestant theologians have spelled out what that might look like. It ends up looking more like a pantheism than it does a traditional monotheistic worldview. So that's potentially problematic for most mainstream Christians and Catholics. A third option is to say, take in the little more Platonic, Augustinian element earlier in Christianity and just emphasize more fully the idea that insofar as and to the extent that something is, it is to that extent good, which gets you pretty darn close to a notion of intrinsic value. There's a little bit of a rhetorical difference perhaps there, but an older ontological discussion of the idea of goodness being that it is to that extent, the extent to which it is to that extent good, not just because of its relationship to me, but because of its participation, in this case, in the divine. So it still probably transitions into a theocentrism. But I think if you emphasize that more, then it's not just a more enlightened anthropocentrism. So I am troubled by it, and I don't think it's been really worked out. I think that's, it's so new within even the Catholic tradition, it's only a couple decades long old, exactly what this renewed stewardship model means, that to my mind it's still being worked out. Does that get close to answering your question?
I have just a follow-up question for the important point that Brian just mentioned, but is this notion of dominion as empowering one's force on the created order, I'll ask this in two parts. Is that something that goes back to the Christian tradition generally, or is that more of a product of the Industrial Revolution? The reason why
British in particular, I mean, I think it is a monarchical conception, and we frequently use monarchical language to describe the divine anyway, right? But and quick comment, and then we can have people jump in. I think White goes a little far in ascribing most of the blame to Christianity, so I should note that right up front. I would agree with what Brian just said, and that I think there is some historical culpability. That's as far as I'm willing to go. There's a complicity and a certain degree of actual culpability in creating a worldview unintentionally, which facilitated a certain attitude, in part because of probably a problematic understanding of what dominion meant. So I think a bad interpretation, a more monarchical, despotic understanding of dominion, which is bad. Again, I'm saying bad exegesis in the first place. I would personally, myself, add the modern conception of which emphasizes the dualism between humans and the world more dramatically. So if you combine the Cartesian split between thinking things and extended things, that just makes it so much more dramatic, and it drains nature of any forms, any essences that it might have had before as well, which is also usually the source of the good of that individual. So it takes something that was already there in kernel and exaggerates it even more, making it even more possible to be. So for myself, I would take modernity and a certain element of Christianity as being, not even co-blame, but equally, you know, having both responsible for creating an atmosphere where this sort of destructive attitude is possible. So I think White goes too far in emphasizing the blame that Christianity specifically holds. So he goes, it's too simplistic. It's more complicated, much, much more complicated than to say it's Christianity's fault.
Okay. This is a comment, I guess, if we go along with your last remark. I mean, White's book has been subjected to some pretty severe criticism. Well, at least that seems persuasive to me. Jeremy Collins, a Jewish medievalist, has argued that, in fact, if you look at Christic texts, if you look at medieval texts, he can't find any texts in Judaism or Christianity that interpret Genesis along the lines that Lynn White does. And then the other part of the criticism, which is not Collins' criticism, would be that, well, but you really can find, then where did it come from, right? That you really can find what exploitative attitudes towards nature, particularly in early modern philosophy. So, for example, there's a passage in Machiavelli, right, where we need to put nature on the rack and force her to yield her secrets. Or there's Bacon's comment about how we need to use nature, quote, for the relief of man's estate, unquote. Or how pre-modern knowledge, Christian and Greek for that matter, was only the boyhood of science. It could talk but not generate. And what we need is a natural science that will force nature to yield her mysteries to us so we can use nature as a commodity. So I guess my question is that, I mean, apparently you want to defend by at least to a certain extent.
Yeah, and I don't know if I would say I would want to defend White in particular, but rather the position that he's defending. So in other words, I'm not in principle, but not necessarily in specific. He makes specific claims about Christianity and the rise of science and technology also, which I'm not quite qualified, I don't think, to say. So I'm using him as representative of a view, which what we need is a sort of a genealogy, which in a way you're doing a genealogy of these ideas. It is certainly the case when I can tell you when I'm teaching this material, that a dominant view among the students is the idea of justifying their behavior because everything is for me. That's what its purpose is. It's here for me, which seems it fits the mold of, well, that's the natural order. The natural order is that the world was created for me, and that's its purpose. Its purpose is to be at my disposal. And so I am largely with you in blaming modernity. I'm still rather convinced, though, that Christianity did wash away a view, an animism, which would have put an ethical break on certain behaviors. As I was saying to another student today, if you're in an animist worldview, if you believe that spirits are in nature, certain even possibilities would never occur to you. It would never occur to you to take the top off of a mountain. It wouldn't have you know, you wouldn't say, well, can we do it, and what sort of economic consideration, you know, you wouldn't even get to that point, because it would have never even occurred to you if you thought the mountain was part of your sacred community. It would have, and so the point is that by creating a, by whisking that worldview away and replacing it with an unfortunately thin sort of interpretation, I don't think I could probably point to specific passages, because it's rarely the case that you've got actually educated scholars within the church, within a monastery, advocating for a particular position. Usually it's some sort of a much more inchoate, much more implicit sort of general worldview, which is much harder to pin down, which makes it harder for you to respond to me also. But so I think it's more of in the air, it's more of an ether sort of view than it is you can point to this scholar who's responsible for having defended this very unfortunate view of dominion.
Cohen also makes some comments that he could sort of give an empirical cast of this thesis. And he says he can't find any reason to think that ancient Christians or ancient Jews were any more exploitative towards their natural environment than ancient Romans or Greeks who were, pagans. So I mean, I suppose there could be an empirical test that seems to come. But let me just ask you about this other point you make about anthropomorphism. Anthropocentrism.
Right.
Excuse me. And you make it seem to me clearly what's the right point is that, of course, anthropocentrism isn't Christian or Jewish or Muslim. I mean, all of these faiths are theocentric, ultimately. But here's my question. I mean, if under God, human beings are the most important thing, okay? And if we say that nature was given to human beings, well, then does that make nature a subhuman nature or a non-human nature? Let's use more jaundiced term, okay? Does that make non-human nature more or less valuable?
Less.
Well, why does it make us, if human beings are good and nature is for human beings, doesn't the value of humanity then also extend to nature?
Say that last part again.
Doesn't the value or the significance of human beings then extend also to nature?
Isn't nature
valuable because of human beings are so
important? Well, anthropocentrism would be the view that it's only valuable because of its relationship to human beings, and only insofar as it's relatable to human. Which I don't think is you could say that's the case, but is that the only reason? And that's what I'm questioning. It is also valuable because it's also valuable to humans who are also valuable very much so in their own right. But I don't think it's necessary to make the further claim that nature is only valuable because of, and especially when we put this within a cosmic scheme of things, you've got a 14 billion year history nearly. Right, and humans arrived in terms of an identifiable species only a couple million years ago. So we've got, almost 14 billion years of history without any humans on the scene. And to say that none of that was good or meaningful or valuable in its own right prior to our arrival seems to be the height of sort of arrogance, and that's just an unnecessary view.
But when the human beings come on the scene, does that make the previous years more or less valuable?
It makes the universe having the total sum of greater value, I think, is pretty easy to say. So in a way, I mean, I have thought and written quite a bit about this question about the relationship between an ontological hierarchy and one's moral scheme. And I think that there are two different movements. You can make the claim that humans are, biologically, we have the largest brain proportionate to our body mass of any being. We seem to have a complex brain as well, so you can give some biological justification for sort of a hierarchy. The question, though, is can you translate that neatly into a moral claim? And then, to me, that needs to be separately justified.
I'm not asking whether you think that it's right to say that human needs are higher than nature, or not. But the biblical account perhaps implies that. Okay, and so if you accept the biblical account, if you're in that sense anthropocentric, the question to me is, well then, okay, it seems to me that if you're thinking along those lines, that would actually make
what checks does that give on one's one's actions in the world is the question that I'm more interested in. So I can say yes to your question. What does that mean, practically speaking? Does that mean that I should limit my behavior to the world because the natural world is also good in its own right? Or is, if I think it's only good because of its relationship or usefulness to me, then I'm, in the more crass sense of economics, I'm only interested in whether or not I can economically justify my behavior to it this way or that way. And if I limit myself, if I avoid cutting down the rainforest, it's only because it might affect other humans, right? You're reduced to an indirect duties view. If you can infirm the intrinsic value of nature, then you have to have some duties to it for its sake to protect it as well.
Is the idea that it's now more valuable because it serves humans? And once we show up on the scene, now it gets its extra value because now it can serve us, something it couldn't do before?
Well, I don't know if I'd really use the word serve, but it seems to me that it would have, let's say that nature has a certain value, and then if you add something into the scheme that's an even greater value, and you say that the lower is now for the higher. Well, I honestly don't know the answer to this question, but it seems to me it might be the case that this has the effect not of making the lower now less valuable, but in fact more valuable.
It's more instrumentally valuable, but it's not more intrinsically valuable.
It would be like a laptop.
Like a laptop.
Yeah. Now that we're around, that gentleman's laptop has an increased value because it can serve us.
And then wouldn't that be a question whether does that change its intrinsic value?
That's what I'm questioning. That's what I'm questioning. I'm saying its intrinsic value is independent of its relationship to me. I'm quite a politeness in this line. I think the Augustinian line is a good one to emphasize, and it's not emphasized sufficiently. If you simply correlate existence with goodness, you've got a good correspondent to the intrinsic value debate within environmental ethics, which can push this farther. I don't know why I don't know of any Catholic scholars who've gone this direction. I don't understand why particularly. I feel like I'm missing something. David, you
have? Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, along the lines of value prior to human beings being on the scene, it's like, can't some evidence of intrinsic value be evidenced by some of the natural schemes of things? Like, taking in Darwinian thought, like, things have central nervous systems in order to protect them from things that are hostile to them, and kind of to protect their complexity as less complex organisms have to come up with other defense schemes. It's like, doesn't that notion of having a defense scheme or a protection mechanism like hint at some kind of intrinsic value or some value that this object must be protected or has to be protected? Like, I mean, is that a valid way of approaching kind of a value concept?
That's a big question, because we'd have to know more what we think about Darwin and evolution, and whether or not it's random and pure chance, or whether or not there's meaningful sort of directedness in it. I think we'd have to answer that question to fully say, because if you just have a random mutation which happens to give you unexpectedly a chance, by chance you're more fit to survive in this environment, therefore you reproduce by, and it's all by chance, then the answer would be no. I'm not saying that's a necessary position, but we'd have to answer whether it's purely meaningless and random and pure chance or not before we can say whether or not it means that something's intrinsically valuable. It's certainly, there's a survival instinct, which maybe you're getting at, sort of the will to live idea.
Yeah, I want to return to Barry again, just because he always speaks of nature as given. So he talks about the gift and the givenness of nature. And in that, he's affirming that it has intrinsic worth as is. Even though humans are going to have to take it in hand and, as he quotes, break the body and blood of creation to fashion to something to make us live. But, you know, so for instance, he talks about, so what I'm saying is that in terms of relationship to all that, he says that whenever you come onto a piece of land, because he's a farmer, He says, you can't touch that land for at least 3 or so years. Because he talks about the knowledge of it, knowing the interdependence of all the beings, that you can't touch a tree in a certain way, and how it cuts and moves down and destroys other parts of the ecosystem. So he's saying that, so his sense of knowledge, because we are tapping into, I think, some epistemological questions, he's saying his understanding of knowledge is affection. It's not just the romantic affection for something, but it's affection for a place such that one is so there that they know the interconnectedness of all the beings. For instance, when he came onto this land in Kentucky where he was, he speaks about spending 17 years healing a hillside that was degraded by poor methods and poor care and so forth. And he says you can still see the scar, but this notion that that the hillside and the nature and everything there does have intrinsic, it's given. We did not create, we didn't fashion any of it. It's given. And I would say that that has deeper religious significance.
I want to get to Michael's point, but one more just to add on to your comment is, John Paul II notes, and a lot of people emphasize as well, that the order of nature for this view isn't morally neutral. The order of nature is a created order. So there, if there's an integrity, if we discover through ecology and biology that there's an amazing interdependent relationship between organisms, for the Christian thinker, that order is not a neutral thing. It's a created order, and so therefore it has an actual positive normative content that you're supposed to protect the order which is, right? So the discovery through science of the order of nature, in fact, is a prescription for how you ought to act. It's a rejection of the naturalistic fallacy to a certain degree that how things are suggests how they ought to be, because it's a created order with an integrity of its own. So in violating and disrupting the natural integrity of nature, you're disrupting the plan, right? The providential plan. So it's not a neutral ordering, which is, I think it's maybe better back to your question in a way. The way things are is morally important.
This is one of the Christian ideas of reverence and love come into play. And I think, this is what you were actually getting at. I wasn't quite getting it. That human beings can relate to nature as creation and bringing with it its own moral goodness in non-instrumental way. We can love it. We can have reverence for it. And that itself brings it into a relationship, because you can't have reverence for or love something instrumental. Once you have that relationship with it, you have whatever phrase you want to use, with a value that raises you up. So is that more? Okay, that makes sense.
And with the origin of humans, you also have the origination of moral agents. Previously, you might have had a universe of moral patients, but until you have something complex enough to be conscious and free enough to be responsible, you don't have anything that's an agent who can choose. And so there would be a new additional sort of a value there. But now you have moral agency, and therefore you have moral responsibility, where you didn't before, prior to the origination of such complex sorts of beings. Might be even very patient, I'm sorry.
No.
Farming in nature's image. That's the phrase that some agrarians use. Farm in nature's image. So check out Wes Jackson at the Land Institute.
You
let nature do what it has been given to do. And that's that reverence and givenness.
Well, it's father probably would, right?
Yeah.
This, I had a follow-up question that seems to be in the center of what these gentlemen have been talking about. You mentioned the Sabbath, and Dr. Stevenson was talking about this problem of the nature being seen instrumental. I seem to recall, but I'm mentioning this for you to respond to, since you are a theologian among us. I recall that in the biblical narrative, Judah goes away into captivity for 70 years because that's how many years they failed to allow the land to rest. And so Judah had committed a crime against the land. And as a matter of having to pay for that, they end up
that's a pretty a vast area, but I would just say that there's lots written in the sense that, yeah, how well Israel abided by that Sabbath rule about allowing the land. Jewish scholars, Christian scholars debate. It's there. It is no doubt in the biblical record. How much they adhere to it is another question. So that notion, notice that allowing the land to be, to let it be, to rest, but also to let the poor, the alien, so again that connection to the poor, to come through and glean and to take what is left of the fruit of the land and to actually have a piece of that land back. So people, land, and community are intimately tied up with that notion of the Sabbath. And the notion of seven is also, in biblical numerology, is also quite significant, and also in the Mediterranean world.
So are you reducing the crime against the land to really being a crime against the poor, or are you saying both are the case?
Yeah, both are the case. So whatever you do, right, they're I'm just simply saying that they're connected. So for instance, when you read the prophets, when they talk about the restoration, it is almost always in terms of the land, of the people, of the community, to reestablish that their religious identity. They are nobody in nowhere without that care of the land. And their images are one of a fruitful, abundant land where everyone shares in it. The vision that they lost through sin, in a sense.
I'm wondering if the talk about regarding nature with instrumental value is, if we're thinking in false dichotomy terms here, and here's what's behind my thinking. I think you're absolutely right, Brian, that one of the key advances of Christianity was to, well, in Judaism really, it's most Judaism and Christianity, is to desacralize nature. Nature is not holy in its own right. But that's the whole point of your observation about theocentrism. But that doesn't mean that nature is merely instrumental, right? I'm thinking of a sort of basic reference here in the beginning of Book 2 of the Republic when they're talking about the different ways that things are good, and they say, well, essentially they spell out instrumental value, things that are intrinsically good, and things that are both intrinsically and instrumentally good. So nasty medicine is only instrumentally good, but sight is both instrumentally good because we don't bump into things when we walk around having sight, but we also joy in, revel in vision as something good. It seems then that if you say Christianity desacralizes nature, it's only guilty of instrumentalizing nature if it has no resources to argue for nature having intrinsic value. So human beings, it's certainly true that the account argues that nature has instrumental value for human beings. But you've mentioned the Augustinian resources, but it seems to me that Christianity also has resources from pagan philosophy. Not only, when you talked about pantheism as a possible move that's going to not be too attractive to lots of at least Orthodox Christians, but through the Aristotelian and Thomistic tradition, in the light of the comments that several people have made, it's interesting to me that you could appeal to this idea of nature being full of beings that have powers, and it's good for those powers to be actualized. I mean, you can think about things like the potentialities inherent in a forest.
Or you don't like process thinking, but why it actually relies on the sophist, where he's talking about being as acting, as a power, as an
right.
acting in the world, and takes that as being the basic comment about what a being is an acting in the world, and focuses on those late passages and makes a lot of them. I think it, and I shouldn't have implied that they're either instrumental or intrinsic. Most of the time, anything with intrinsic value also has instrumental value. So I have intrinsic value that I can also give you a ride to the
right.
store, right? So it's
well,
not
the question in the case of
Christianity
and nature is that it's giving nature instrumental value. At least the argument goes that it strips it of intrinsic value. That's
yes, and I agree with you. The only problematic view, then one that I'm meant to criticize, is the view that you're right that it reduces nature to merely an instrumental
right.
value. That, and I would say there are resources for it to say
pagan and Christian to say that it has intrinsic value as well. And maybe to put it, come around to your point, because I think I'm agreeing with you, that what it does to say that it has intrinsic value, that it's good in its own right, to use more classical language, that it is good. And we can say that it's good, right, without having to talk about humans, to say it's good in its own right, insofar as it's achieving and pursuing and achieving its end, right, in an Aristotelian sense, it's good for it, makes my relationship to it moral, right? So that's one of the main points that I'm trying to emphasize, which is that when you make it a purely instrumental value, when you strip it of all intrinsic value, then what I do to it is not a matter of morality anymore.
Right.
What I do to the chair is only a moral issue insofar as I have a relationship to the university, but I don't owe the chair anything for its own sake, right? Indirect duties only. And so by saying that nature has some is good in its own right, then restores the idea that what I do to it is a moral relationship, therefore it needs to be justified. And your bigger moral framework is going to explain how you can justify this relationship or that relationship, whether it be a hierarchical conception or a Rawlsian view or something, right, or something else. But my basic point, my main point in bringing this up is to say that now, within the stewardship model, what you do to nature is a moral issue. So as we have these big debates nationally about what we should or shouldn't do, and they're almost exclusively about how much will it cost, what technological improvements can we make, it needs to be also a moral debate. It needs to be a matter of, does my view of reality require me to act in certain ways ethically, not just a matter of prudence and practicality and economics in the crass, bold sense, but also, can I morally justify this behavior or that? You might be able to, but now you have to justify it morally, whereas before you didn't.
Well, my question is, can you talk about some of the solutions to solve this? And one of them was advocating for the buy local policy of sustainable living. But were it not for the fact that we exploited lithium fields in South America, our friends with the laptops in the room wouldn't have the laptops to begin with. Were it not for the fact we exploited the coral reefs and the rainforest, we wouldn't have some of the synthetic medications that we do. And if we do go into a buy local policy, it'll deny a vast majority of the world basic necessities. Now here in Washington, we're blessed with abundance, and I don't need a pineapple in the middle of December. I'd like one, but I don't need one. But there are certain parts of the world, especially in Africa and the Middle East, where it's impossible to grow staples like wheat and corn and rice that are basic necessities to people's quality of life. So would you agree that some of the solutions you propose are a self-imposed exile into a progressive society, or at least force us to restrict some of our development? I mean, it would deny access to food, it would deny people access to certain medications that have arguably improved the quality of life.
Sure. No, excellent question. By no means sort of such a localism that it's isolationist or exclusionary, but what I'm saying is more kind of regional economies, right? In other words, you go as far as you need to go to kind of supply those needs. If people are in need, then we produce for them and you find those ways. But the system as it stands right now, though, is it's not actually beneficial. You know, we call this region of Washington, you know, we feed the world with our wheat, when in point of fact, it also continues to drive other farming communities into poverty because of our dumping. So I'm saying, I understand your point. It's well taken, I would say, but, you know, even, say in the national security issue, you know, 2004, when Tommy Thompson was leaving the Housing and Urban Development Department, his one question was, I have no idea why those terrorists have not attacked our food system. Why? Because it's these very single lines that are driven around the world by such groups like Cargill, the transnationals. They control, they actually tell farmers what to grow. So I'm saying that I'm not such holding it in such an isolationist sense, but the sense that strong regional economies that are, for the most part, sufficient unto themselves, and then you reach out as far as you need to go.
Your point about India is a good one to emphasize here as well, right? So the sense in which cultures are changing and actually wiping out, you know, long-standing indigenous cultures which have had sustainable forms of living. I'm somewhat sympathetic to your general point, the idea that not everybody could do this, but it's also the case that each community has grown up in and filled their own sort of ecological niche with their own patterns. And the claim doesn't have to be, and this is the problem with some environmentalists, the claim to say that nature has intrinsic value doesn't necessarily mean that it immediately has the same value as humans. I mean, it could mean that, but it doesn't. You don't want to jump to that assumption, right? To say something has value doesn't mean that you have to say it has it equally, right? So the two different steps. It just simply means you have to justify your actions. So the question is, could you, if it would be significantly important enough, you could justify the destruction of other things. This is where Barry's nice. Whitehead makes a similar claim. He says, life is robbery, but robbery requires justification. So life necessarily, all forms of life involve destruction. The question for a moral agent is whether or not you can justify this form of destruction or that form. It's not merely an economic question. It's also moral. If it's morally important enough, if you can justify it, okay. Can you justify, you know, having a monoculture in which you are destructive unnecessarily? Instead, have more sustainable methods, more local. It's not a sort of all or nothing. I think you're right. If it was sort of simplistic, and then it could be damaging. But it need not be. Need not be simplistically implemented.
Barry would make that argument, said this sort of simplification in application of knowledge destroys invention. So globalization, which was we thought was going to kind of really embrace and celebrate all this diversity, has actually made us all the same.
Right.
We're all the same. And has actually squelched some of that.
Including the richness of genetic diversity.
The genetic, absolutely. So.
Well, the conversation can and should continue if you'd like to stick around, but we try to end roughly on time. Let's thank our speakers.